Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings, I'm Cody Cook. My guest is Germinal G. Van, an author, economist, and scholar who was born and raised in West Africa's Ivory Coast, who immigrated to the United States in 2010. He's written for the Foundation for Economic Education and the Mises Institute, as the author of The Economic Condition of Black America and the 20th Century, Historical and Empirical Analysis, which is what I asked him to come and talk about. So, Germinal, thanks for taking time to talk with me.
Thank you very much, Woody. Appreciate it.
So, first of all, I'm interested in your background. What got you interested in economics and what brought you to the United States?
Okay, so why don't we start by what brought me to the United States before we got into economics?
Sure.
Because my interest for economics came much later. So I always wanted to live in the U.S. I remember when I was 10 years old, I told my mom that one day I would come to the United States. I don't know why. There's a very famous French proverb that says, I don't know if you guys say the same in English, but probably you guys have something similar to that, which says, the heart has its reasons that reason itself ignores. So I couldn't explain why I wanted to come to the U.S., but there was something inside me that was telling me that it's in the United States. But I always liked the Anglo-Saxon mentality too. So that is definitely one factor that drove me to the U.S. But even when I was 10 years old, I didn't know about the Anglo-Saxon mentality. Of course not. This is something I got to learn when I was in high school.
Speaking about the Anglo-Saxon mentality, is that like kind of like the empiricism, kind of rationalism type stuff?
Yeah, empiricism, pragmatism, specifically pragmatism. I always love, the Anglo-Saxon mentality. So I would have been honestly comfortable living in not just the U.S., but the United Kingdom, Ireland, English-speaking Canada, Australia, New Zealand. So basically those places, because it's just the same mentality or the same framework. I mean, it's still the same framework there. So, but I wanted to come to the U.S. because by then, when I made my firm decision, I was mature enough to understand that the United States is the only country on earth where you can actually start at zero and become successful. You don't have that opportunity in Europe. In Europe, of course, there are Africans who are successful, but they're mainly athletes or musicians. I've never seen African entrepreneurs who are making millions or billions of dollars or euros in Europe. It just doesn't happen. Why? Because the system is not designed for that. But in the United States, which inherited the Anglo-Saxon pragmatic mentality, which emphasized that you do not need to have a PhD to be successful in life. That's America. So I understood that I have a best shot at coming here and work my way up. So I decided to, that's why I wanted to come to the U.S. And so I came in 2010. I went to the Catholic University of America, where I got my bachelor's degree in political science. This is actually one of my biggest regrets, but we'll come into that later. The subject that I studied. And I got my master's degree in the same field from the George Washington University, which is also in Washington, D.C. And then I wanted to go to law school after getting my master's. But to me, going to law school wasn't become a lawyer. It was more about becoming a politician. But you had conventional wisdom that to become a politician, you need to have a law degree. So I wanted to fit in that conventional wisdom. Took the LSAT three times, failed, couldn't get into law school. I mean, I got into law school, but not into the schools that I want. I got into three law schools, but they were not geographically fit for my wife and I. It wouldn't be good. That's why I end up not going to law school. And I got into writing because I felt intellectually insulted. Let me explain why, what I mean. So when I was studying for the LSAT, I was like, those kids who are getting to law school are not smarter than me. Why they Why do they have that I don't have that makes them get into law school? But of course, you know, standardized tests in America, there's the language barrier. That is a factor too. But I realized that I have a gift for writing. I always enjoy immersing myself into the analysis of fundamental ideas. So that's why I started to write. And then, I mean, I started to write a very long time ago. I started writing like books that I never published because I wasn't able to complete them. So it was in 2018, I've decided to complete one manuscript and then publish it by all means. So I decided to write and publish my first book, which I did through Amazon, through the self-published platform, which is actually a great platform for anybody who wants to express his talent and his ideas. And it's a great source of income too. I mean, don't get me wrong, it won't make you rich from the get-go, but if you keep going at it, yes, it will definitely get you there. And then through my scholarly journey, I start drifting more into economics when I move from the Republican Party to libertarian ideas. Because libertarian ideas are more focused on economics than any other political idea. So that's when my interest in economics sparked, and I started reading Hayek, Mises, Rothbard, and Thomas Sowell, and Milton Friedman, and all these free market guys. And that's when I got stuck into economics.
That's interesting. Well, I was going to say, if law school wasn't your path to be a politician, you could always try reality TV. That seems to be the new.
Yeah, I mean, with the current president we have, which sure, it is the new way.
Yeah, so you mentioned, you know, there's obviously the French influence in the Ivory Coast, and you went to Catholic university. So I wondered, do you have a Catholic background, or?
So I was not born Catholic, but I was born a Christian. My mom converted to Catholicism over 15 years ago. My sister got baptized about 3 or 4 years ago. I'm the one who is the black sheep of the family when it comes to religion. Because, and this is my personal view, I know your platform, it's like oriented towards theology to some extent. But it's just that to me, I never truly believe in religion. I always distinguish religion from spirituality. And to me, religion was just like a tool for people to dominate others. That's why I never liked it. But spirituality, of course, I believe that there is a higher being, a supreme being, that is the master of the universe. And because I believe there is an invisible world, you know, there is a lot of stuff that human knowledge cannot explain. And I think that's even where the concept of God comes into, but this is something else we can talk about. I'll talk about metaphysics. But
it's really interesting. Well, yes. I think you talk about your partiality for Western ideas, because it sounds very much like sort of an enlightenment approach to God. And it makes me think of the Ethiopian philosopher Zira Yacob, who was kind of a predecessor to the Western Enlightenment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's really interesting. Sorry, we're not really going to talk in detail about theology or anything like that, but I was curious about your background. So I'm interested in talking about your book, The Economic Condition of Black America in the 20th Century, which is on Amazon if anybody's interested. So I actually had it for a couple months before I read it because I expected it to be difficult reading. And despite the thoughtful analysis and the use of charts and graphs, it was actually quite readable. And so I'm curious, what made you want to write this book?
Great question. And why I wanted to write this book was because I wanted to understand why Africans or African immigrants are more successful than African Americans or native-born Black people in America. And I must say that immigrants have a very different mentality than native-born. And it's not just African immigrants, but whether it's African immigrants, Indians, if you notice, Asians, when we come here, we don't play around. We come in to take everything. Like, we're like, this is our opportunity. I remember when my father brought me here, he was saying, this is your gift for graduating high school, is to be in the US. That's it. Now it's your job to make it your own. So we understand that here we have the opportunities that we don't have in our own, in our homeland. So while we're here, we were very focused on achieving, on acquiring resources, material success, and whatever that can improve our living standard. And I didn't feel the same way about African Americans. I like, they taking here for granted, but it's understandable too, because that's the only place they know. You know, they be brought here by force. We cannot deny that. They be brought here by force. They be subjugated for more than 100 years. They lived as second-class citizens. They did not have access to all the resources they need to build the wealth, as the way Europeans had those same resources. So it really intrigued me. So I knew that it really intrigued me. But I'm like, okay, if you guys know all of this, why don't you decide to change your condition instead of having that victimhood mentality? So I was thinking, oh, slavery, because of slavery, it's been for, I understand, yes, it happens. We also have colonization too. Colonization in Africa has happened. And colonization is actually not that different than slavery. It's just slavory at home. That's all. It's just that Europeans came and imposed slavery on our soil instead of taking us to a foreign land. So it's the same concept. So it's not that slavery is special just in America. It has happened in Brazil, in Cuba. It has happened even in Europe, where people used to enslave themselves. Asians, Japanese used to enslave Chinese and vice versa. So Japan colonized China, in case you didn't know. So yes, even people of the same skin color enslaved themselves. But I understood that racism, in fact, is not based on skin color. It is based on social class. This is one thing where I agree with Karl Marx, although I detest, not the man, because I don't know the man, but I detest his work. But I respect his work, the intellectual construct of it, but I detest the substance of the work, if that makes sense. But there's one thing I agree with, is that, yes, human societies are divided into social classes. And we attribute social classes to race. Or we attribute race to social classes, or vice versa, wherever. But is that I made a YouTube video explaining that racism, in fact, started in Asia, where the people that were the rich, the wealthy in society were called whites, because we associate whites with intellectual brightness, with aristocracy, with the creation of wealth, and etc. So everything that represents the success of humanity. And then the reds were the guardians. So they were the ones that actually protect the upper class. They protect the whites. So that was the military, the guardians. And then you have the blacks. The blacks, we don't call them black because they were black by skin color. We call them blacks because they were at the lower class of society. They were at the bottom. So they were the craftsmen. So basically the layman. The layman is the black man. That's what it is. So it was those guys who could never really reach the level of the aristocracy. Basically, like, they're doomed to be there. And then it was that concept that they attributed now, and they divided human tribes into race, because race deals with animals, not with human beings. Human beings are not like animals, so we Europeans use that concept of race to distinguish human beings and say that, okay, you're from an inferior race, you're from a superior race, and so on. And this fourth concept has since then been the main concept that distinguishes people. So I wanted to understand in America, like, what maintaining black people in the level of poverty they are. I'm like, why someone like me, who left my country to come here, is better off than the native born? Because, for instance, before I became a legal resident in the U.S., I came with a visa. And when you're a student, you cannot take loans. Whether it's, you can take private loans, but you cannot take public loans. So, and if someone is not willing to give you a loan privately for you to pursue your education, you're pretty much screwed. But in my mind, I was like, African Americans have the opportunity to take loans. They can pursue their education. Why they don't do it? Why they rather focus on things that will not build their skills to make them competitive in the labor market? So that's what that was one of the reasons what drove me to write this book. So I'm like, let me try to understand what has happened in the 20th century. How did they economically evolve? Because of course, Black people are much better off economically today than they were at the time of slavery or in the 19th century. That's a fact. Today, the poorest Black man in America, he has a smartphone. I mean, if you have a smartphone, you're not poor. Like, you have people in Africa who are extremely poor. Many African villages don't have electricity. They don't have clean water. They don't have any infrastructures to go to school or to get medical attention or just to file an administrative document. They have none of that. But in the U.S., the poorest man in this country has access to all of that. So I feel like, to some extent, yes, Black people have been oppressed for a very long time, but they're nonetheless still privileged compared to the Black man who lives in Africa and who doesn't have access to basic goods. So I wanted to understand what was the motive behind that. That's why I wanted to write this book.
Well, you know, you talk about kind of race as a social class thing. It made me think about, so in the West, what it essentially emerged is under this sort of heading is like scientific social planning, which is why I think, you know, Hayek kind of links those things together in his book, The Road to Serfdom, where he talks, because he's dealing with the rise of Nazism, and he makes these connections with social planning and this kind of ethnic stratification of society. So on this question of why Black immigrants tend to be more successful than Black people who were born in the United States, that's a really interesting question. And I was just reading Beverly Daniel Tatum's book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria, where she takes a broadly progressive line for explaining where there might be some kind of a disparity along racial lines. But even she, interestingly enough, she talks about, like, for example, Asians seem to be, because you would expect immigrants, if you kind of use this what's the term, where you sort of have these kind of concentric circles of privilege and that kind of thing. And she said, well, you know, you expect an immigrant would be in an even worse place, but yet you look at Asian immigrants and they tend to generally be in a much better place. And she argued that a lot of that is the result of the...
Oh, yeah, those guys are doing... Those guys are...
Yeah. Well, what she kind of pointed out, though, was that in a lot of cases, there's a bit of a selection bias, so that a lot of the people who are coming here from Asia are kind of the cream of the crop. They're people who have graduated college already, or their parents attained college. And so her argument was that it's not entirely fair to compare. But even she pointed out that, well, at the same time, there's an element of culture here that makes a difference. And so I'm interested in kind of your analysis as you've looked at the condition of the economic condition of Black people in America, what you see as the kind of ups and downs and what's behind them. And so, you know, the way I've perceived the story about the economic condition of Black people in America is that it's basically like static between emancipation and civil rights. So there's emancipation, so that brings up to one level, and then it basically doesn't change until civil rights. And then it's been basically a slow upward climb since then. But your book tells a more complicated story. What would you say are some of the significant turning points in the fortunes of Black Americans in the previous century?
So what has happened, in fact, was that Black people were forced to rely on the market process before the civil rights. It was difficult, but when you look at the history of the Black community, they have Black Wall Street. In the 19th century, even before the abolition of slavery, you already had some Black people who were very rich. I talked about that in the introduction. You have like Wilcox, for instance, who was a sailor, and he made a lot of money. There's another one who had a restaurant at 22 years old. In the 19th century America, where you have a political system completely dominated by a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And yet you have some Blacks who were able to thrive. So that's why I don't completely buy the notion of white privilege. I acknowledge white privilege. Book, I even said in the conclusion that yes, it does exist, but it is not the factor that prevented Black people from moving upwards, because Black people did move upwards. So,
well, I was going to say, you don't mention this in the book, but there were a number of elected Black politicians to Congress in the 19th century, and then that suddenly disappeared.
Yes, I did not.
Yeah.
Indeed, yes. I didn't even mention that, but that's very true, because I was focusing more on their economic condition rather than the political condition. So Black people were using the market process to emancipate themselves, and it worked. Black people were creating businesses. Booker T. Washington was advocating for Black people to get skills. Say, guys, you need to educate yourself. Once again, when we say educating yourself, we do not mean go get a PhD. No, we're saying read books, learn by doing it. See people who have done it before you and learn from them so you can do the same way, so you can emancipate yourself. Skills emancipate you, because once you know how to do something, you have it for life. Practice doesn't make it perfect, it makes it permanent. That's a real deal. And that's what Booker T. Washington was saying. He was saying, like, guys, I understand. For now, we live in a situation where we have to accept all the political and social injustices against, but let's focus on developing our skills. Let's focus on creating businesses. Let's focus on expanding our community and improve our living standard. That's what Booker T. Washington was saying. And Du Bois was saying the opposite. Du Bois said was not completely wrong, but it was saying basically like that Black people cannot really thrive because there is a system that is already established that prevents them from doing so. But in the long run, Du Bois has been proved wrong. He has been proven wrong that this system has probably maintained Black people for a long time in the second class citizenship, but it did not prevent them from moving upwards. In the 1920s, for instance, the Roaring Twenties, Black people had a higher rate of self-unemployment than whites. This is something that people don't know. It's in the book. I put in data about it. And you see, the decline, in fact, started slowly with the New Deal. And then when Lyndon Johnson took power, when he passed the civil rights legislation, what happened is that there was a social contract that was established between the Black community and a political party. So the Democratic Party says, okay, we're going to give you guys a set of rights, which will enable you to basically have the same rights as us. But in exchange, every election cycle, you better vote for us. So there's a social contract. So what has happened is that Black people were politically, they were emancipated, but economically it was like a downgrade. It was a downgrade because that's when the welfare state now expanded. The welfare state already existed, but it expanded under Lyndon Johnson. The welfare state expanded and Black people become more and more dependent those welfare programs, because those welfare programs have good intentions and people do not judge policies by their results. They judge it by their intentions. So it makes more Black people becoming dependent on the welfare state, and the welfare state start to keep them in a perpetual state of poverty. So it prevents Black people basically from becoming more entrepreneurial for a while. And then, of course, like in the book, I also attacked Republicans, especially Nixon, for the war on drugs to maintain Black people as second-class citizens, and he racialized poverty. So basically, it wasn't just Democrats, it was government. Both parties contributed to maintain Black people as a group of second-class citizens. So it was the market. Is because Blacks rely on the market that they were able to improve their living conditions throughout the century.
Well, and you kind of said this conversation that ultimately W.E.B. Du Bois was kind of proven wrong. Although I kind of remember in the book you highlighting some of the things he was kind of correct about, and it seems that you are saying that the market has had a well when white people have access to a free market, they're able to prove themselves, even in America. But there are things that can stand in the way of that. And that was the other kind of element that you talked about in the book. And you kind of hinted at here when you talked about the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, I mean, prior to that, the role of the government in sort of basically standing aside during lynching and all these other sort of factors, basically, people can't be free when they, well, actually, as I said, I was just listening to the Econ Talk podcast where they had Lisa Cook on, who was talking about the role of racism and black inventors not being able to get patents. And so there is this kind of this twofold thing. On the one hand, the government, at least your book seems to say that when the government doesn't guarantee the rights of black people, they can't move forward. So there's kind of this combination of the government guaranteeing rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but also staying out of the way apart from that.
That's what constitutionalism is. Constitutionalism is limited government. The role of the government is to do three things: to secure liberty, to secure the life of individuals, to secure the liberty and then property. And in 1865, slavery was abolished. Black people became full legal citizens. What has happened? The federal government said, okay, you guys are free now. Do whatever you want. But don't forget that we were in the South. And in the South, whites were not happy about the fact that slavery is no longer the economic system that built their state. Then they were no longer happy about the fact that they have to see the people that they were using as tools of economic system now becoming free to do whatever they want. They're not going to accept that. And when slavery was abolished, few things happened. The 13th Amendment was passed, which abolished slavery constitutionally, so legally speaking. The 14th Amendment was passed, which gave the right to full citizenship to anybody, including black people. And the 15th Amendment was passed, which gave black people the right to vote. So black people had the right to vote for a very long time, and they couldn't really vote. I mean, they've been voting, but their vote did not really have any impact. And these three amendments, it was the role and the duty of the federal government to enhance that, to protect that. And it didn't, because don't forget that the U.S. government, the U.S. Constitution, should I say, trumps state constitutions. It trumps state law. So when you have a regional or local government oppressing you, you have to size the federal government to make the regional or the local government stop its oppression on you. That's why we have a United States Supreme Court. State Supreme Court. So when the state Supreme Court makes a decision that is not in your favor, you appeal to the Supreme Court. And what happened? The Supreme Court in 1896 made it separate but legal. No Plessy v. Ferguson. And it was the role of the federal government to protect the rights of black people. Yeah. So black people could not really thrive because they couldn't rely on a government that would protect their rights. At the end of the day, black people were already citizens like whites. But the government didn't do anything about it until what? The 1960s. So that was one of the reasons why black people have been lagging considerably behind, because they didn't have enough access to the political process in order to create the wealth. They didn't.
Well, and I think what's interesting is, as you read the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution, there's an assumption that I think we have now that our rights were protected from the state, federal, and local government, that those rights were things that all levels of government had to recognize. But that wasn't really traditionally how that was understood. It was essentially understood that the Bill of Rights protected us from federal government intrusion. And then once the 14th Amendment comes in, and they talk about, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor deprive any person of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, property, and or sorry, life, liberty, or property without due process of law. what essentially the 14th Amendment was trying to do was to say, well, listen, it's not only true that the federal government can't violate individual rights, also state governments can't do that. And it's the federal government's job to stick up for the individual. So it used to be that the argument was essentially about states' rights versus federal government's rights. And the 14th Amendment tried to kind of shift things where they belong, which was on the rights of the individual. But the Supreme Court did not read the 14th Amendment the way it actually was stated.
Yeah.
Part of this issue was whether or not the privileges or immunities clause in the 14th Amendment was the same as the privileges and immunities that was mentioned in Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution, right? So I'm like, I'm a libertarian myself, and I vacillate a little bit because sometimes I think, something like, sometimes anarcho-capitalism sounds really, really good to me. But then when I read about how state governments have oppressed the rights of individuals and how the federal government didn't do its job to stick up, it makes me sort of think, wow, maybe that needs to be clear that, the state is really there as the Declaration of Independence suggests it is, in order to protect rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it's, so I think you kind of argue for a minimal role of government to protect those rights. And I wonder...
I'm a minarchist.
You're a minarchist. Yeah. And I am too, but sometimes I lean anarchist. But I guess considering the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, redlining, all these other things, some would argue that African Americans actually need a proactive government focused on redistribution, affirmative action, and other playing field levelers, that basically the system is so corrupt that just basically standing back and allowing the market to do its thing is not enough to raise, to create a level playing field where Black people can be successful. That the system is such that they don't actually have the same agency as white people do. And so I wonder what you think about that argument. And then, of course, I think we got ahead a little bit when you talked about the war on drugs and Nixon and the welfare state, but maybe this would be a good time to see how, whether you think that's been a net positive or a net negative for Black Americans.
What I find interesting is how Blacks are asking for the government to redistribute the wealth while it is that very same government that put them in that position in the first place. So that's what makes me laugh about this thing. The market knows no color. I think when the market redistributes the wealth, it does it equitably. It rewards those who produce over the parasites, while those who don't produce well, they don't eat. But when the government redistributes the wealth, it doesn't even do it equitably either. It's going to do it at the expense of some people. And Blacks are asking for the government to redistribute the wealth. The government implements or imposes more taxation on people and to create some programs, but those programs are not even effective. Those programs don't help Black people emancipating themselves. That's the thing. Black people were more economically emancipated in the early 20th century than after the civil rights. Because Black people rely on the market process, they were able to, and it's funny because that was a time where it was very difficult for Black people. They barely have rights. And yet they still thrive. They were better off than after the civil rights.
A bit better off economically.
Yeah, economically, yes. That's why.
Yeah, obviously in some ways they were not.
No, of course.
Yeah. But what you're essentially arguing though for is that some of the things that happened with civil rights legislation were long overdue. The protection of Black people to be able to vote and be treated equally by the state, were long overdue. But essentially, when the government comes in and tries to take the reins economically and try to sort of plan who gets what, things don't improve. And I guess so. And that seems counterintuitive, right? Because it seems that if you give people money that don't have access to money, that should better their fortunes, right? And why is it that that's not the case?
Simply because the government is not good at allocating resources. Simple as that. Why the government is not good at allocating resources? Because the government doesn't think in terms of profit. When you think in terms of profit, you know how to allocate your resources. For instance, this podcast is probably, I don't know if it's your full-time job, but this podcast is a way for you to eat. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're generating some money from that podcast. So you know exactly on how to allocate the resources to make your podcast grow and to become, you know, to become a great platform. But what if me and the government are coming and say, oh, Cody, I'm taking control of your podcast. I'm the one going to allocate the resources for your podcast. Do you think the results would be the same? Of course not. Because I don't think in terms of profit. Because for the government to remain relevant in its action, it needs to implement regulations on programs. The government always comes with the fact that the market fails. We need regulations to make things equitable so that we have fair competition rules and competition laws. That being said, the government's the one then who decides what company gets what, how companies should allocate their resources. And they create programs for that. Those programs eventually become ineffective. And when they become ineffective, the government says, oh yeah, those programs didn't run correctly because we didn't have enough resources. So what we're going to do to make those programs run better, we're going to create other programs that will actually do a better job than the previous program. So they create new programs that do CPR on the previous program. But how do you create a government program? It's through taxation, always. So they're going to increase taxation again. And then that same program that new program that they create will eventually short run and it will become ineffective. And then they have to create another program again because, as I say, government does not think in terms of profit. It thinks in terms of expansion of power. The more regulation they implement on a government program or on the market, the more it increases the power of government and it helps government create its own monopoly. Because if government thinks in terms of profit, bureaucrats will become irrelevant because they will allocate resources efficiently. So there will be no other regulations to implement. So the job is done. So the policy, the program has to not work. It has to fail. That's how they stay in business.
Well, so then I guess another factor that I'd be curious to get your thoughts on is the role that dependence plays. The dependency plays on questions like motivation. So for example, if you're in a position where you know that you have guaranteed income from the state, if you do nothing, But on the other hand, if you try to better yourself and sort of take control of your economic life, you know that the government is going to stand in the way of that. That it's going to be more difficult. That they're going to, you know, remove that safety net for you. And then, you know, for example, let's say you know you braid black hair, and that's something you do well, and you were taught to do it by your mother. And then you try to do it on your own to make a little bit of money on the side. And then the state comes in and says, well, you're not allowed to do that because you haven't completed a cosmetological certification that the state requires you to do. And so it seems that it can remove the motivation for black independence or not just black independence, but poor. I mean, I live in a majority white neighborhood that is, you know, very kind of heavy dependency on the state. And I see the same kind of things, you know, that people tend to associate with black poverty. And so obviously the factor there is not color. The factor is the role of the government's flag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's no, for sure. That's what it is. Like, that's the problem of the welfare state. And I see the next question is like, as a lot of black Americans being helped or harmed by the expansion of the welfare. And that's what it is. The government implements the welfare and say, okay, we're going to give you income. On the other hand, you have to do what we tell you. So you see that you're no longer free. If you decide to work and what you make from your work is above what we give you, well, you no longer get that. So people, they're like, oh, you know what? I'm getting free income. Why should I work for, you know, well, there's no point to work if I get free income. And it makes the government becoming the new parent, the parents of the community. And that's bad. It has never been the role of the government parenting people. The government is here to simply protect, to preserve the life, liberty, and property of people. That's all. Nothing more, nothing less than that. That's why a government exists in the first place. You're here Because if I want, for instance, to open a business, I need a legality that says that this is my property. That's why government is here. I sign a paper that the government recognize that, okay, this is Germano's business. This is his property. And he has a right to run whatever the way he wants. If I am a free citizen, if I did not commit any crime and someone attacked me for no reason, it is the role of the government to protect me through the police. If someone tried to murder me, it is the role of the government to protect me through the police as well. So the role of the government to protect my life, my freedom, and to ensure that I have access to the resources that will help me create the wealth, that will help me participate in the economy. Those are the three essential functions. And then, of course, for which I'm not opposed to government creating infrastructures, because and the reason why I'm saying that is because Americans tend to not understand sometimes that government has a role to play, especially in Africa. Because in Africa, there are many places that are poor. And the reason why there's poverty is because there's no infrastructures. And the market process works when there are infrastructures. This is one thing libertarians sometimes fail to comprehend. They talk about the market. Yes, but you need infrastructures for the market to work. And you need peace and security for the market to work. Why? Because no one will go put his money in a place where there is no political stability. That is one of the reasons why Africa is lagging economically, because people do not want to go put the money in a place where they can lose it tomorrow because there is a war somewhere. They don't want that.
Which is perhaps why China is spending so much time investing in infrastructure in Africa as their
own. Exactly. And that's why libertarians don't get that. Well, that's in that instance, the government is necessary. We need governments to build roads, to build infrastructure. We're not saying the government should own these infrastructures. The government should build these infrastructures, and most of those infrastructures must be owned privately, if necessary, if possible. That's my point. Of course, the road where everybody's driving, I mean, that one, it doesn't bother me if the government owns the highway or, I'm not going to print the ANCAP card here. Like, on those ones, I think government has a role to play. Where the government doesn't have a role to play is when it tries to control private enterprise, when government tried to control the education system, when the government tried to control the healthcare system. That's where I believe that the government has no role to play.
But
infrastructures, yeah.
But when a process works well organically, the government can only make it worse, I guess.
Exactly. Exactly.
So before we talked about infrastructure, you were talking about the role of the government in protecting people from having their rights violated by criminals or those who would want to hurt them. And that kind of brings me to the next question, which was, it was hoped that the war on drugs and Bill Clinton's crime bill would help Black communities by removing a criminal element from the Black community so that law-abiding Black people could thrive. And so that seems to be in line, at least on the surface, with what you were saying about the government protecting people. But that didn't seem to pan out. That seemed to have been a net negative for Black communities and for Black economic independence. So why is it that in this case, that kind of government involvement wasn't helpful?
Well, it wasn't helpful because the motive was not to actually make law-abiding Black people thrive. The motive was to maintain Black people once again as second-class citizens. We all saw Joe Biden's speech in 1993 justifying his bill, why we need the crime bill of 1994, would say, for my sake, for your sake, for our children's sake, we need to get those guys out of the street. Like, he was talking, he wasn't stuttering at all. Fun fact. People say, oh, Joe Biden stuttered. But he wasn't stuttering. He knew what he was saying. He was very articulated, very convincing about why we need to be tough on Black people. And sure, like, the policy has been effective. It has reduced crime significantly, but it decimated an important portion of the Black population, because those people, because the three-strike rule was, the three-strike rule was not necessary. It shouldn't be that harsh. Like, if it was for, because for whites, Joe Biden would have probably created the policy of rehabilitation. But for Blacks, three-strike rule, you're out and you stay. And they were incentivizing prisons to maintain criminals there, and they will give them like more funds, more subsidies if the criminals were not able to have parole. Like, it's a business. And of course, Black people were the victim of that business, because there was already, at that point, what is important to understand about the 1994 crime bill is that at that point when it was implemented, the racialization of poverty was consumed. It was already there. We already associate Blacks with poverty, Blacks with crime, and Blacks with failure. And that was, the racialization of poverty, in fact, was enhanced during Reagan. Although in the book, I say that I kind of defended Reagan a little bit, saying like, okay, income within the Black community increased under Reagan, but when Reagan was calling Black people welfare queens, he was saying that, oh, they're, it's because of them we cannot get out of the welfare. Although at this time, there was more white people on welfare than Blacks. See? But it was that false narrative that Nixon created in the first place. The racialization of poverty, that's when it was finally established under Reagan. So when Joe Biden argued for his bill, it was done. Black people need to be locked out because they're the one who create all the trouble we have.
Well, I think that's the irony of the progressive narrative on systemic racism.
Yeah.
Is that they want to expand the system.
They always want to expand the system.
Yeah.
No, no, go ahead.
No, I mean, I think there's good evidence that there's racism inherent in the system. But right. and the evidence is there every time the government expands its power, because you see more racist outcomes.
I mean, of course.
Yeah, trying to expand the government even more is not going to fix that problem.
Yeah, and that's the thing with progressivism, is that progressivism wants to make change in society through use of government. But once again, people think that judging something by its intention is enough for it to work. It is not enough for it to work. It doesn't work like that. It's, you have to judge by the results, and the results overwhelming. The expansion of the state apparatus creates more disparities within people, especially in a country like the United States, which is not a homogeneous country. That's what makes this country unique when it comes to social issues.
Yeah, for sure. So you broke into this a little bit at the beginning, but I kind of wanted to talk to you about the difference in how immigrants see this Black immigrants see this issue versus Black people who were born here. And I've been spending a lot of time recently trying to get different Black perspectives on you know, the Black situation in America. And so, you know, obviously the most common view is the progressive one, which sees ongoing racism and racist systems as holding Black people back. And then, of course, there's more conservative Black perspectives that see like the victim mindset and acceptance of criminality, lack of family structure resulting from welfare as the primary causes of disparities between Black and white. And so there is more diversity among native-born Black people than is often acknowledged, but it seems that Black immigrants in particular have even more varied opinions. There's more diversity in how they experience being Black in America and what they think, you know, the results of disparities are. And I want to know what you think accounts for that difference. Is do you think that you see things more clearly because you're like, you weren't reared here, you're more objective because you're kind of an outsider coming in and looking at it? Or do you think something you're missing somehow?
I don't think I'm missing anything.
Yeah, I'm sure you don't think there's something you're missing, but I guess...
I don't think that I'm missing anything at all. Instead, I've been here long enough to understand the dichotomy. Of course, like, when I've been here, I've lived with white people most of my life in the US. Of course, in Africa, because I'm not going to be hanging out with white there because I'm hanging out with my students. But in the US, since I've been here, I mean, the Catholic University is a white school. George Washington University is a white school. All my friends, most of my friends are white. My wife is white. We in white neighborhoods, being treated with respect personally. I mean, here I'm speaking from my personal experience. I've been treated with respect. I've never encountered open racism since I've been in America. Maybe people say stuff behind my back. I don't know. And I don't care. I have no proof that they're saying things behind my back, but some do probably. Who knows that? Who cares? But I've never experienced open racism. I've never seen a black or white person coming to me and calling me a nigger or whatever racial slur. So I've never felt like a white person was taking my job or I couldn't get a job because of a white person. Instead, I was born in a family where I've been taught that skills is what will set you free. If you apply for a job, you're not picked, and the person who's been picked is a white person, maybe in the long run, that job would have caused a lot of problems. So in fact, God made you a favor for you to not get that. That's how I see life. If you want something that bad and you don't get it, it means something. It means that maybe it's not for you. And down the line, it would have harmed you. So for me, like, I don't see my life being a huge impediment because white people do not allow me to thrive. I'm writing my books. You know what is funny? I write a lot of books about Africa. I even wrote about, you know, the African-American culture and, you know, the book that we're talking about. And my audience is white. They're the one who are buying it. Black people don't buy my stuff. You see what I mean? Black people don't buy my stuff. I've written a couple of books on the economics of Africa. It's white people who are reading my stuff. Black people don't. You know, I'm not saying I will never ever see that white privilege doesn't exist. It exists. Because to call white privilege a myth, it's an insult. That's where I strongly disagree with Candice Owens and all the conservative stars, as I like to call them, the conservative star, Candice Owens, Brandon Tatum, and all these guys. Because to say that white privilege is a myth is to say that Jim Crow never existed, slavery never existed, eugenics never existed, redlining policies never existed. You see what I mean? Like, that's what a myth is. A myth is something that never existed. Those things existed. Yeah. So yes, white privilege exists, but it's no longer a factor to the advancement of, it's no longer a factor in preventing black people from thriving economically. It is no longer a factor. Today, you have black people who are billionaires. You have black people who are CEOs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, and I think, yeah, the argument is that the racism is more insidious and hard to pinpoint. And so I think that you can, yeah, I think there's, I've heard some pretty persuasive arguments for seeing it in ways that you might not expect. And, you know, systems kind of, you know, have vestigial racism, like we talked about the war on drugs and things like that. But yeah, I think there to look at the situation we're in today and say that black people cannot advance, I think is to insult black people.
Yeah, it is because like us, as I said, like when Africans come here, we're not coming here to play. We don't have time for that black race. No, we're focused, man. We're on a mission here. We're on a mission. When we come here, we're coming to improve our lives. We're coming here to have a better life. That's why everybody's coming here. If the United States was that bad, why this country would have over a million immigrants pouring into the country every year? Why people don't go to Europe to try to live the dream? Why people don't go to China? Do you think in China you even have amendments that protect your rights? Sometimes like people take this country for granted.
Which I assume you'd say is not to say that there isn't anything to fix. I mean, sometimes people will say on the right.
I mean, of course, there's stuff to fix.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, there's stuff to fix.
I mean, if you'll hear sometimes people on the right say things like, you know, obviously there's no problem here with, you know, racism or anti-immigration sentiment because look at how many immigrants are coming from south of the border. Well, obviously, there's something here that's good that they're seeing, But that doesn't mean that there's nothing bad or there's nothing that needs
to. No, of course, like the US has its flaws, but the problem is that people are not nuanced. They're acting like it all the time that way. That's the problem. No, you have to be nuanced. And the nuance is that the United States is not perfect. The United States has its flaws. It has a dark, within its history has, it has a dark side. But the benefits outweigh the inconveniences in this country. That's the real and most accurate answer. And what you get in this country, the opportunities you have in this country, you will not have that in China. I'm sorry, Chinese people do not see Black people as their equals. Mm. At least white people are trying to make some effort to respect Black people. In China, bro, do you think those guys would come and write a constitution that would give you right? In China, Black people would have to be slaves by now. Well, no, I'm serious.
Yeah, my understanding is that China has essentially blamed COVID outbreaks on Black people in China.
Yeah, you see?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's, people need to get out of the country a little bit to understand some realities. Because most of the people that you will see keep complaining about, yes, it's because of racism, we cannot thrive, because of this, we can't do that. Those are the same that never leave the country. Mm. And they're the same that watch the same media. So they got intellectually intoxicated by that false narrative. Of course, yes, there is racism. There are some places in the United States where there is racism. If I go in the Appalachia, for sure, I don't think I will have the same respect that I've earned from my white friends. Like the white people who are there, they're not accustomed to Blacks or whatever races. I mean, that happens because they're just backwards. Because they live in backwards places. It's the same in Pennsylvania, the rednecks, or those almost of whites who live in the Bible Belt. Like, that's the way it is, but does it mean that you cannot thrive because of them? They're not the majority.
So then when you talked about narrative, it kind of brought me back to this question of why Black people who are born here might see things, generally more differently than Black immigrants might. Why there's a progressive narrative that's more pervasive. And do you think that what's going on is that there's this narrative that's there, that's present, that's imbibed, and then it gets passed along, and then there's kind of a confirmation bias. I remember I was listening to a Fifth Column podcast with Camille Foster, where he talked about, he made an interesting comment that really stuck with me, which was, I wonder how many times I've experienced racism and didn't realize it, because I'm not quick to assume that that's what's going on. And it seems to me that there are going to be, if you have a narrative that racism is everywhere, then you are more likely to see it, even if it isn't there.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a bit of a confirmation bias that sort of allows that.
Yeah, and the confirmation bias is that in the Black community, kids are taught by their parents. That's the first thing they're taught by their parents. It's to teach them about the history of slavery. When you do that at a young, I'm not saying yes, of course, those kids need to know about slavery. It's part of the country's history. But when you start by that and explaining that it is based on that we have all these problems, what do you want the kid to expect? Instead of teaching the kids science, right? Science, instead of teaching the kid math and all these natural science disciplines that will help the kid thrive, because the reality is this. Okay, the reality is this. Right now, no one cares if you are oppressed or not. If you have the skills, especially the scientific skills, believe me, your race will not matter. People will hire you for what you can offer to the market, for what you can offer to the company. Believe me, a Black person who is working as a data analyst or a data scientist will not say that he's oppressed. The guy is making six figures. Easy. So it's always those same people studying the humanities, those philosophy thing, saying, oh, you're oppressed because they romanticize everything. The reality is that we live in a world now where you prove that you are worthy to your skills. That's how you make the difference. And believe me, a white person doesn't have time to judge, oh, because of his skill color, I'm not going to hire him. No, if you have the skills, the guy will hire you. It's a market price. Do not look at that and look at color. The guy needs a workforce and you need money to pay your bills. So the deal is done. It goes both ways.
Well, and it seems that, I mean, I think of, are you familiar with Blaise Pascal, who had the famous wager about belief in God, that if you don't believe in God and then, you know, you die and there's no afterlife, then it doesn't really matter. You didn't lose anything. But if you don't believe in God and there is an afterlife, then you've lost something. But if you do believe in God, whether there's a God or not, there is no afterlife, there isn't, you don't lose anything. So his argument was, it's a net negative to not believe in God, depending on which way things go, you know. And so I feel like there's something similar to be said here where, you know, you sort of came to this country with an attitude that I think was enculturated for you, which was if you work hard, you'll succeed.
Well, yeah. When I came in, I was about to say that when I came in, I remember in the plane, I was like, I'm coming to dominate those guys. I'm not coming to play around. I was like, I always had that motivation since 2010. I was like determined to make my way here.
Well, but it seems that even if you were a little bit wrong about that, you'd have more of a chance of succeeding because that was your attitude. Whereas if somebody has an attitude that I can't succeed in this country because the deck is stacked against me, whether they're right or whether they're wrong, they're going to fail because that attitude straight out of the gate.
Absolutely. You nailed it. Absolutely. That's exactly the attitude. And plus, like people who come here who have the attitude that I have, they necessarily succeed. It's just that the success doesn't come immediately, but it comes eventually because they are consistent.
Sure. Well, yeah, and there's you know, on the far progressive side, there are people who are saying that, you know, if you went to school for, you know, gender studies or art history and you can't find a job, then you're owed a living. No matter, even if you can't sell, nobody wants to buy what you're selling. So, you know, as we kind of touched on, my podcast is primarily interested in Christian theology, but it does touch on political and social issues where I think, you know, they seem to intersect with Christian thought and ethics. And so what got me interested in talking with you is that, you know, Christians should be interested in the ability of all people to flourish without regard to race. I mean, I think that's a pretty core Christian value. And we can't really talk about how to fix the problems of black and white disparity until we can discern what's causing them and propping them up. So, you know, white Christians in the United States anyway, seem to be divided on this issue of whether racism is the cause of these disparities that we see between black and white or not. And I think even when there is agreement that there are racist causes behind disparities, there's a suspicion of progressive solutions, which are seen as strengthening racial divisions instead of aiming toward Martin Luther King Jr.'s solution of judging by individual character instead of color. So I guess what I'm really interested in trying to figure out is, do we fix the disparities we see, whether they're caused by racism or not, by spending more time talking about racial collectivism or by spending more time talking about individualism and how to, you know, allow individuals to flourish without being burdened?
The latter.
Yeah. That was a big setup for me to just kind of ask you a question that seemed kind of, yeah. So
definitely the latter, because it's like, you see, let's say you're injured. And instead of thinking about how you're going to heal your injury, you keep focusing on the fact that you're injured and why you're injured. Mm-hmm. How focusing about why you're injured will help you fix your injury or heal your injury. So it's and that's the thing, progress. They focus too much. I'm not saying that what they're doing is bad. Not that it's bad, but it's the wrong approach. They're focusing too much on the problem instead of focusing on the solution. You see, let's put comparison here. People who focus more on individualism and they're more like solutions, or they're more solutions like oriented. They want to get things done. They're more pragmatic. The progressives are more romantic. It's that romantic approach, that emotional approach. They think that it's by focusing on the emotion that you will get to something. You won't get into anything. The only thing you get on emotion is to complain. You complain. No matter what happens, you will never be satisfied. And that's why you see progressives, no matter what laws we pass, they will always find something that is not enough and they're going to go on the street and complain about it. Look at feminism. Since the 1920s, women wanted the right to vote. We gave them the right to vote. They wanted to have economic rights. We gave them a woman can have like a bank account. She doesn't need her husband's approval. A woman can create her own business. She has access to private property. She has access to the resources to build the wealth. But today, they still say, you're oppressed about what? What is oppressing you? I don't. What rights don't you have in 2020? You see what I mean? It's the same. Like I'm telling you, Cody, like in 2050, the white race will be the minority in this country. And you will still find some black people who say that they're oppressed. Why? Because they need to complain. Imagine if progressives stop complaining. Progressivism dies. That's the thing. They need to keep going. Otherwise, it becomes irrelevant. It's the same with government, when I said earlier. If government doesn't implement regulations on the program, if the thing is they start thinking in terms of profit, then the bureaucrats will become irrelevant. It's the same thing with progressivism.
Well, it makes me think of some comment that I'd made about in the past about how Trumpism kind of pulls from Nietzsche's philosophy of resentment, that the people who are always looking for someone to blame for their problem. And you see it among, you know, the white right that feel like, hey, this is my country. Why am I not successful? Who can I blame for?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's the same. Yeah. It's that attitude of focusing on the problem rather than the solution.
Well, we've been talking for a while. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I might let you close on this question, unless you want to close somewhere else, which is, can a libertarian political philosophy appeal to Black Americans who are steeped in a worldview that looks for answers within a progressive mindset?
You know, first of all, I have to say I do no longer label myself as a libertarian. I consider more myself as a classical liberal, more like a Lockean, you know, for John Locke, a Lockean classical liberal. Because one of the core values of libertarianism is the non-aggression pact, of the non-aggression principle. That's how you guys call it. And I don't believe in it. I don't believe in it because it's too abstract and utopian. It's not everyone who wants to do good. Unfortunately, that's like you have people who genuinely, they take pleasure in harming others. So when you answer libertarians, the nap. No, it's not the nap like that. And that's one of the reasons why I believe that we need government. But of course, I will choose libertarianism 100 times over progressivism. If I have to incite more Black people to come to libertarianism, I'd rather do that than to let them perish in progressivism.
Well, maybe I'll reframe the question as, what do you think is stopping Black people from being interested in a classical liberal viewpoint?
What make them stop is that, how can I put it? I'm trying to formulate my answer. The question is very easy, but I can't give an easy answer for some reason. What prevents Black people, yes, I think, is that they still believe that they need government for social changes. That is the problem. That is the reason why a lot of Blacks are Democrats in this country, or don't say Democratic Party that never wanted them to be emancipated in the first place. It's a Democratic Party that encouraged slavery and Jim Crow and all the social slurs that they've been through. But it's that Black folks think they still believe that the government has a considerable role to play. To me, the best way is to bring back the values of the church. Because the although I'm not a religious person, the Black community and Black people in general are highly embedded in the belief of God, in the belief of a higher authority. So if we're able to combine Christian values with classical liberalism, that I think will have a significant impact in incentivizing more Black people to believe in classical liberalism, although classical liberalism, in fact, was a rebellion against Christianity, kind of. it was more, not against Christianity, but against the church. That's what it was, because there's a distinction between Christianity and the church. Christianity is the belief, the religious belief that is personal, and the church is an organization.
There's also sort of the strains of Christian enlightenment and humanist enlightenment, so it gets kind of messy, but...
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think like messy, yeah, I think amalgamating the two will be a good stepping stone for Blacks to start embracing more classical liberal values.
Well, and I think too of more kind of laissez-faire, you know, Black thinkers like Frederick Douglass and Malcolm X, who basically said, get off my back and I'll do fine.
Yeah. No, Black people believe in laissez-faire. It's just that fear that, oh, what if government is not here? Because that's what they've been accustomed to. That's what they know. That's the only thing they know. That's why you have many Blacks who are in politics, and the political system doesn't improve their lives.
Yeah. Well, Jermall Van is the author of The Economic Condition of Black America in the 20th Century, a Historical and Empirical Analysis, which I got on Amazon. I read it on Kindle. And is there a website or any or social media that people should check into if they want to see what you're up to?
Instagram. I know I've always wanted to create my own website. I've been slackening on it, but I prefer Instagram. That's where I post basically everything.
And you got a series of YouTube videos too, correct?
Yeah, I do have YouTube videos where I'm teaching econometrics for anyone that is interested in learning how to run linear regressions and using basically empirical tools in economic analysis. Yes, I do that. But most of my videos address what we talk about: political issues and social issues and economic issues.
Well, Jermall, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me. It was a really interesting and engaging conversation, and I'm glad to have been able to have it with you.
Thank you very much, Cody. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello everyone, it's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.